All right, looks like we've got everyone. So welcome, thanks for coming to my presentation. Believe me, I wouldn't want to listen to myself being talking for an hour. So you guys are pretty brave all in all. My name is Nathan Gonzalez. I'm from Chicago, and I work for Clarity Consulting, which is also based in Chicago. We're a consulting firm who works with a lot of different Microsoft technologies across the board, Windows 8, Windows 7 Phone, Microsoft Lync. And we were tagged by Microsoft to do the HTML5 port of Contra Azure. So before we get started, show of hands, who has either played the game or heard of the game in any form? All right, we got some people. So I guess we'll just start, for those who don't know, by a nice video because, in school, teachers, when they wanted to be lazy, they showed a video to their students, and I like being lazy. So we'll see what Contra Azure is all about. All right, so that was kind of a preview of the game. More background information on it is that it's a 2D puzzler released for the iPhone in August of 2011. And at that time, it received multiple critical awards from some of the big names in the games industry, such as IGN gave it one of the finalists for the best mobile game of E3, along with others. So it's been a very critically acclaimed and well-received game. Just this past little while in September, they also released a Windows Phone 7 version of the game. So if you have that, you can download and play it there as well. What really makes the game unique, as opposed to a lot of the other mobile games that you see on the market today, are a variety of things, such as the art style, the sound. You heard the music that's actually done by a professional composer, and also how it does a lot of the back-end stuff, the under-the-hood stuff that most people won't care about besides us. It does a lot of dynamic drawing to get all those graphic effects you saw. It just doesn't use a bunch of pictures and draws them over and over again, but actually uses lower-level graphics APIs to draw dynamic curves and dynamic shapes and to just give the game a very, very authentic feel that you don't see in many other games. And Microsoft approached us because they wanted to port this game to the web. So we did that. That was launched in October of this year. It's gotten about 1.5 million unique visitors so far, so it's done pretty well for itself, and has been a great success for Microsoft. So I'm going to talk today about three different sections, and I'm going to have to ask you guys to kind of shift your level of thinking today, because the past few presentations have been more about UX design and those kind of concepts. But this is different. This is actually going to be a presentation about programming styles and such like that. It's going to have code snippets. It's going to have some demos and stuff. It's going to be a little different. And it's going to talk about things such as lower-level drawing APIs like OpenGL, if anyone's ever worked with it, or a little bit of physics engines, but I promise I won't talk too much about that because we'll all get headaches. And you might ask, why did I pick these three topics? Well, a high level of why I picked the topics were because I know not all of us in the room will ever get a chance to work on a game. A lot of you are just app developers or develop for different, you know, different types of apps. So, but this is a question of why should you even listen to me? Maybe you should take a nap for the next half hour or so, because we all love naps. So why should you care about these three sections? What I did is I tried to bring the three sections today that I think affect us all. The first one being performance, because JavaScript apps are increasingly complex these days. This game had 80 JavaScript files with thousands upon thousands of lines of JavaScript code. So as things get more complex, the need for performance from your apps is going to be greater. If you don't pay attention to that, you might come up with this awesome idea, you know, awesome animations, things pop in and pop out, and everyone's like, whoa, that's cool. And then when you load it up on like a regular device, like a tablet, it's just going to not function because it's going to be so slow. Touch integration is another big one, because we all, over the past year or two, have started to be introduced to touch devices. And this is an area where browsers have generally been very behind the times. You know, when you use a browser application on your iPad or something like that, you're generally not getting a full touch experience. So how to do this in your apps in HTML5 is very important. And the last thing is graphics. And graphics is also very important because, I mean, everyone loves pretty stuff, don't they? I mean, you can make the best app, but if it's not pretty, no one's really going to pay attention to it, unfortunately. So it's nice to know how to draw stuff. As simple as that sounds, it's nice to know, like, how to do things that aren't just images. How you make an app that really feels dynamic and stuff. And it's also nice to know that in some sections that we'll get to, it's easier to do stuff in HTML5 than it really is for other languages like OpenGL or even XNA in C# world. So the first subject is going to be really, what's the big difference for us with compiled languages versus JavaScript? And because everyone knows that traditionally JavaScript hasn't always been the fastest language. I mean, everyone's seen those websites that are really, really slow, and not because of your connection, just because, you know, it's JavaScript has been unable to handle the task that you want to give it to it. And this is especially a problem for gaming. Gaming is one of the most intensive things you can do. And it really, if you can make a game run on a browser, you're really giving a testament to that browser's speed and its ability to do stuff. Some things that have traditionally made gaming unable to be performed in the browser are things like floating point math. Needs to be done quickly because there's a ton of it, but you can't do it because of JavaScript's like concepts of, you know, what is this? Is this really a floating point number, or is this a string, or what is this? What am I being given? You destroy and create lots of objects dynamically, which, you know, is bad for your garbage collection and is going to really slow you down. And it requires object-oriented programming traditionally, because that's usually the status of the gaming industry. That's how we do stuff. And also being able to, the most important one on the top, is being able to update the world in a callback fashion. Because a lot of what you see in games is done by, not by an event-driven UI system like most of us are comfortable with if you make apps, but a timer, calling back the game 60 times, hopefully 60 times in a second, to update and draw itself. So if you can't even call back with efficiency into the browser, you won't be able to get a clean user experience. Traditionally, compiled languages have been the way to go to make games. C++, C#, they all have a lot of advantages. You know, with native languages, you can just do stuff that you can't really do in JavaScript. To make objects, even in C++, you can make an object on the stack. No calls to new, no calls to, you know, delete the object, no garbage collector. So if you need to make a million objects in a very short amount of time, so what? The language doesn't care. It'll just make a big stack, and with very little to no performance cost to you guys, the programmers. And languages like C Sharp lose some of these capabilities because they are managed with the garbage collector, but they can still do things like floating point math very fast, and they have access to other drawing APIs that are traditionally a lot faster than HTML. Or to be honest, before HTML5, you couldn't even do it in HTML because it was just strictly DOM elements. If you wanted to draw lots of sprites and stuff like that on a, you know, on in a game world, you couldn't do it at all. So traditionally, the browsers have been kind of out of luck. So with games, you'd always see games in Flash or, you know, some other plugin, but not in the actual browser. And another note here, as you can see, the last one. So Max, who could, the original creator of the game, who could not be with us today, he, when he had to port this game to C Sharp, he had a lot of different problems with it compared to native. But he was able to get around that by using some techniques such as, if you made a lot of objects, you can just use object pools. And C Sharp also still has access to structs, which is not a class, so it's not really declared on the heap. It's just, like I said, you know, just if it's a it's a vector, so that's two floats, so it's literally 8 bytes just on the stack of your program. So for browsers, now we need to see, like, what happens now. Not, that was the old days. What is it now? So how do browsers perform these days? So, that's not good. So while I worry about that, let's go into the demo. So what you really want to do is you want to stress out the browser. And so I've downloaded onto my machine the four major browsers that I can access on, you know, a Windows device, which are Opera, Firefox, Chrome, and IE10. Just let's see how they perform against each other in a stress test, because the best way to, you know, test something is just, you know, by brute force. Let's try and kill the browser. Let's see what happens. Can we do it? So just to get an idea of how browsers work these days, let's start with Opera, which has been, I think, it's still considered one of the major browsers, but it's not generally as widely used, at least in the States. I don't know about how you guys are over here. So this demo is trying to draw 5,000 images at 60 frames a second. So basically I'm telling the browser, hey, look at this particle system. Please draw me 5,000 images in 16.7 milliseconds and do that 60 times a second. So it's kind of stressful. So Opera, as you can see, if we look at the FPS counter, not handling it too well. 6 FPS, really bad. As a reference, a minimum, a game needs to be running at like 30 FPS, because if it doesn't below that, that's when the eye starts to not see a continuous image and starts to see stuttering, starts to see the images break down into separate slides. So if we go to another browser, such as on the opposite end, let's go to a browser like Chrome, which is generally considered one of the faster browsers for this kind of a thing. And we'll see how it fares once it decides to load. Now, Chrome fares a little better. We got about 20 frames per second here, which, if you think about it, really isn't that bad. That's almost at our target rate. So let's quick examine the other two. And Firefox has also been traditionally considered a faster browser because it's been making the standards and stuff for HTML5. Now we're seeing some movement. Now we're getting up to, you know, 50 FPS, which is really, really good. This is where we want to be for a browser to play a game really in. And so our last one is IE10, which, as we all know, IE10 has never been very much liked, I guess, in the industry. But we're seeing pretty good perf even from IE10. So we're seeing just about as good perf as Firefox, if not better, because we're at 60 frames a second here. So that's really what we want to see. So this tells us we can now make a game such as Contre-Jure. Now, what's interesting here is what we have to consider now is still, as you saw in that demo, not all browsers are created equal. As a developer, you need to be acutely aware of this. because even though you can't control the end user who uses your game in or any other app in a browser, you can at least suggest it. And you should know if you're using, you know, your awesome game and you're working on Opera testing and you're like, oh, I'm such a terrible programmer. Like, I just can't get this thing to perform like I want it. Maybe it's not you. Maybe it's the browser. So consider that when you choose what browser you're going to test on and what browser you're going to use, try and suggest to your end users at least. And so now we get to a little slide that I find very interesting. So I'm going to try and pitch a little bit of IE10 to you, because again, traditionally Internet Explorer has kind of been not the most widely known browser for performance. IE10 has gone through some radical changes recently as Microsoft has been trying to get its performance to best the other browsers, and generally has worked quite well. On Contre-Azure, we generally saw the best performance while testing using IE10. So some of the things that you should be aware of, and that, as an aside, I would suggest you look up on MSDN. There's a blog by Andrew, which is their top-notch guy for Internet Explorer development, and he's been the one who's been like working on their internal JavaScript compiler. If the slides are distributed, this is the link too, you can see. There have been a lot of stuff going on in the IE10 world to make browsers performant. There's been work with floating point math, with object creation and destruction, and all these things that we have decided, as I said in the game, need to be there for a game to run. IE10 has been doing a lot of work trying to get it so that it's the best browser to play a game on. And generally, it's been very successful. I don't have time to go into too much of what the low-level stuff of this. So, but I would suggest if you have any plans in the future of making an application in the browser that you think is really going to stress it out, that's the article to read, because there's a ton of interesting information on it. So the last one on that list that Internet Explorer or that slide didn't really cover is the timer. And request animation frame, I'm sure some of you may have heard it if you've worked in HTML5, is something that's necessary for running a game in the browser. Basically, as the name implies, it's supposed to be for animations, but what it really is a high-speed callback that lets you, you know, tells the browser to do something and then says, please update me again in, you know, 16.7 milliseconds. Traditionally in JavaScript, if you wanted to do this, you would use set interval. But unfortunately, that's not the best way to do it, because set interval is really greedy. It's like the mean bully kid in your high school. You know, it's just like, when a callback, it's just like, ah, give me the callback and let me do my thing. But without disregarding what the browser is actually doing. So request animation frame is very nice. It's very polite. It's saying, please let me update at this time. And when the browser is ready to render onto the screen, it lets it. So we really want to use that if possible. So our performance experience in Contre-Azure was really that what we needed to do was really get down on our object creation, because that was really our bottleneck. We were really stressing out the JavaScript compiler. Now, as you can see in this screenshot I took of IE10's browser window, in an early version of this build, literally in 30 seconds, because of all the math we were doing, we were creating 5.2 million separate objects. Now, if you've ever programmed in JavaScript, I expect you to have a heart attack at this point, because that's really not something you should do. But that's what it takes. That's math is generally creating these objects, because in math you have a vector class, which is, if you're a designer, it's just a point. It's an X and Y point, so it's basically just like a pixel coordinate on the screen, but it's used in math for physics. So we are creating tons and tons of these objects, and it was eating up our performance. You can see right there, that's the second most expensive thing we were doing. So it's a very important problem for us to solve, and we really solved it lazily, which is how we wish all problems would be solved, wouldn't we? We went back to an old way of doing things, which is making things be passed by reference, which has, you know, usually these days has kind of fallen out of favor. You don't really see it done much anymore, at least in my experience, since C++. But in JavaScript, this is what we did, because if we use that, we could manage object creation at the top level of the objects, ensure that all of our objects were created only at the initialization of a game level, and we would free ourselves from making that many objects. So as you can see, the second code snippet is just an example constructor where in the constructor, all these vectors were being made that we would eventually use for the classes, for our elements in the game. And it worked. I mean, look at the results from the current game on live. I pulled these statistics. In the same 30-second interval, we had only 6,400 objects made from 5.2 million. So, I mean, that's a fraction of a percent that that the garbage collector is now having to work for, create and destroy. So we really just saved ourselves a lot of room. So that's something that you guys should think about. When you're developing high-speed JavaScript apps, please, please, please be careful of your object creation. If you don't, it's going to get out of hand and be really bad, and you're going to cry. Second section, touch integration. In mobile applications, like many of you have probably developed, in something like Windows Phone 8 or iPad or iPhone, touch has been it's a lot simpler than it is on the web because there's only one way for us to get touch points. There's one simple interface that we get the touch coordinates back. And even if we have to do a little bit of transforming to get the coordinates to fit into our game's screen, it's okay. It's not that big a deal. As long as we know what we're going to work with, because some of these frameworks might even help us out because they'll tell us, oh, this is the screen size of the app you're at the very least, of the device that you're on. In the web, we aren't always guaranteed that. Let's see. What we have to do in the web is we have to make sure this works for mouse, and we have to make sure this works for touch devices. And in some case, such as your Surface tablet, we need to make sure that it works for both touch and a mouse, because you might decide you don't want to play with touch and you want to have your mouse hooked into the tablet. So we have to not only support both types of input, but we have to implement a system that kind of coagulates all the different ways we can get touch points together. Because you have your traditional mouse events of the JavaScript browser, like mouse up, mouse down, mouse move. You have WebKit's touch system, which is just basically like the iPhone system where it gives you a collection of touches. And then you have the MS Pointer class of IE10, which is very, very helpful because it encapsulates both mouse and touch events all in one class. And it's very, very simple to use as opposed to some of the other systems. So it's just very helpful to us. And we also need to make sure that we can map the touch coordinates we get back from these devices to the appropriate coordinates, because what the game expects, what the game world needs from that canvas you saw in the demo, in the video, is the standard thing is a 960 by 640 game world. So if the touch points are not in that system, if we had to dynamically scale the canvas to fit a smaller device like a phone, we need to tell the world that, or we need to transform the coordinates to the coordinate system of that new scale paradigm, because the game itself is not going to know unless we tell it. So I've just compiled some tricks we use to accomplish all these goals. Touch interface. This is a snippet of code Contributor uses to implement its touch interface. And it's very succinct. All we do is we look and see if it's MS Pointer enabled or if it's the WebKit. And if not, it's just the mouse. So at this point, we can hook up all our events and succinctly know that through the functions, boil down to a default function that will tell us what we need to do at that point in time, which is basically this. After you wrap everything in that outer layer, at the core of it, you need to get these touch points, coordinates, and give it to the browser. Give it to our game. So what we did is, there's a lot of different ways you can get points from the browser. I'm sure some of you have seen it. There's offset points and client X and client Y and page. So we chose to use page because it gives us a static X and Y that's not been scaled at all and is just absolute, so we can transform it ourselves. Because some things like MS Pointer will transform them fine for you. Even if your mouse happens to be above like a different DOM element, it'll handle it for you and give you proper coordinates back. But not all browsers do that, so we have to make sure it works on all browsers. So that snippet of code is what's doing the localization. Basically, we take the offset of the upper left-hand corner of the screen, because that's like our anchor of the game screen. And after that, we get the scale of the container, which is all is as a CSS transform, because if it's a, again, if it's a smaller thing, we need to shrink our game canvas down to fit a teeny phone or, you know, some device like that, even some tablets. And then we get an inverse scale from that, because basically if you have a, if you shrunk down the canvas, you need to blow the canvas points back up to fit our scale, and vice versa. So that's a very simple way to just handle touch coordinates, and that has worked for all of our, all the browsers and everything. And one last point on touch before I get to the meaty section is move events. What traditionally, and I know a lot of JavaScript programmers have for apps done, is it's simple to just say, hey, mouse move event has been detected. In that callback function, please do my game logic, or whatever your app logic is you want on mouse move. For ContraJure, that really wasn't a good option, because you could get, because of the touch, you could get multiple mouse move events in a frame. And if you do that, we have expensive function calls in, that we want to do on mouse move, such as querying the world to see what objects are under your finger. So that's, as you can imagine, kind of expensive. So we don't want to do that any more than absolutely possible. So what we ended up doing, you can see, is we aggregated the touch points into a touch module array. And after we get the chords, we just, all we do is we have in that array the touch ID that's mapped to an object with the touch coordinates, and we just update the coordinates. Thereby, when we update the game loop, we just update the touch module. So at that point, we take the coordinates that we've been aggregating for the entire game section, and then we move the touch. And then we can do that every time. This ensures that we will only process move events once a frame, which is very, very important to, again, making our game performant. Because the mantra is, if your game's not performant, it doesn't matter how cool it is. So that's kind of an overview of touch. If you guys have any more questions about it, feel free to ask me, and we can talk about it in more detail. But I want to move on to the last section, which is graphics. So graphics is probably the most interesting, at least to me, but also hard to understand. But really, I want to explain, talk to you guys about this, because I really want you to get a feel of how we did graphics in like a game like ContraJure, so you can use graphics like this in your game. You know, using images is great, especially if you have great artists, but HTML5 Canvas is an extremely powerful tool that can make things all sorts of dynamic shapes, and if you don't utilize that in your games for, you know, some interactive screen, or I should say for any app, for interactive screen with your app for whatever reason, you're really missing out. It's such a powerful tool. So let's take a look at how we did some of the graphics. But first, I promised we wouldn't get into physics too much, but I have to talk a teeny bit about it, just a teeny bit, so just so we have a basic understanding. So what I want to talk about in the first section is how we draw the snot, which if you saw in the demo was the long black stringy thing that you can hook to Petite to fling them around the level. It's one of the most used articles in the game. You don't need to know too much about the physics, but you need to know that the strand is actually made up of a few bodies, which in physics terms is just a shape with a position and a velocity. And really what we need to know about that is its position. So we can actually get the position of all these bodies that are that make this physics object, which are all connected by a joint, which that joint is what makes them, which makes, for example, the snots string back or be able to stretch out, and like what connects the bodies to each other, what keeps them, you know, in sync with each other. So once we know that, we can understand better how to translate a snot into OpenGL. So what we're doing here is you can see the diagram is basically something like A, B, and C. We get these points from calculating basically just a small offset from those bodies. So we get 4 points to make a square. In OpenGL, you would draw this with triangles because a low-level language like OpenGL or Direct3D, triangles are the most essential thing you can do. Even in the fancy games like Halo 4, they had a slide of that before. Master Chief and his awesomeness and his, you know, the elites and everything else in that game, everything is made with triangles. Even, you know, his armor, his model, it's all just a huge mess of triangles that come together into a shape. So what we do to get a skinny body that looks blurred is we take these, we cut it up into essentially triangles. We draw the two center triangles, which are A, B, and C, and A, C, C, D is a solid shape. And then we take and draw the outer triangles with a gradient. And you can actually do that in OpenGL by, you can specify like at each point what color you want it to be. And then you can specify like a blend mode. So if I specify that C and D are solid color and one of the outer points, G we'll say, because that one isn't labeled by accident. If I say that that is transparent, and it will linearly interpolate across a triangle to give me a gradient that I want. Now, that's all nice in theory, but in a perfect world, it would work out like that. But we're in a world, as you know, UX designers know, of square pixels. That's all we have. So it turns out to be kind of pixelated, as we would expect it. But what that actually translates to is a blurred edge, which is one of those things that we all love to talk about as developers. It's not a bug, it's a feature. And in this time, we can actually say, yes, for our art style like Contrajour, this is a feature. So it's one of the few times when you can actually say that. And it's real exciting. So it's blurred, but that's OK, because it still fits the Contrajour art style and looks very good. Even you can see, even in the background, the background snot, the big eye, they actually enhance the blur to make it fit the art style like you would expect. So I'm almost done, and I'm for a demo, so you guys can kind of see all this in action. But I really want to show you, talk about one more thing, because in HTML5, it is much easier to do what I just talked about. So if you were confused, please forget all that about triangles. Just throw it out. Don't worry about it, because I just wanted to show you how it would be done in a native language, but this is how we would do it in HTML5. We have powerful tools that tell us that we can make a path that can be filled in with a color to make something like a snot. So if the snippet on the right-hand side kind of shows it, we basically have an array of point pairs that make up the snot. So if you have this long snot, it'd be like a pair. And those are all in there. And you can see we get control and anchor points from these pairs. And all we do is we call one function, quadratic curve 2. And that, instead of figuring out the quadratic curve ourselves and tying our code up with lots of triangle manipulation, all we do is we call that thing, and it draws a quadratic curve for us. So, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I think that sounds a lot simpler than doing all that triangulation that was required. So that's all it is. It's just a path, and then you fill the context afterwards. So really, then you ask, what was all that? I mean, which is totally an okay question to ask. So I'm going to try and show you guys a little bit of what I just talked about, because a lot of us think better in pictures than we do in words and in code, especially when it's compressed enough. So this is a demo I made of the game running in, you know, IE10. And what I want to show you guys is this diagram. So this is actually live. This is being drawn in the browser. And so what I want to display is the parts of the snot. The red circles, as you can see, are those physics bodies we talked about. This is what makes up that snot. And this is how it gets its physics. This is how it moves, how it, you know, slings like that. It's all because of the physics engine in the back end, and how it connects to, like, Petit and such like that. But what we do, you can see, is from those bodies, we start calculating those points, which the blue points are just offset of that body by a little bit, and the blue ones that are on top of a red circle are the anchor points, and the ones in the middle, in the center, that actually map to the center of the quadratic curve are control points. And that's literally all that gobbledygook I just talked about boils down into this. You have an array of points, and you draw a curve between them. And it, HTML5 just magically turns it into that. And, you know, I mean, at first glance, you'd never think that. I mean, how would they ever, you know, how would they ever do that? But it's just that simple. It's drawing a quadratic curve. So it's really, without just a little critical thinking and without too much code, it becomes something a lot more interesting. So, moving on a little bit. The other big portion of the game, the thing that really defines the game for us, is the ground. If you saw in that video, I've ever played it, the ground is a very centric part of the game because you manipulate the ground to move Petit to his end goal in most of the levels. And it's actually, under the hood, in the physics world, it's a very complex beast. It's represented by tons and tons of these physics bodies, square physics bodies, which again, in a little diagram, you can kind of see mocked up the squares. And so that is a testament, again, going back to performance, this is a testament to what browsers like IE10 can do now. Hundreds of physics bodies are being taken and calculated in this world without losing perf, staying at 50, 60 frames a second. So again, to think about it, it's really could you imagine, really, this? If I told you this a couple years ago, this would happen, you probably would have laughed at me and, you know, thrown pies at my face and whatever. But this is what can happen now, and it's really great. So when you interact with the ground in the game, you are literally just, you're not changing the shape of the ground per se. You're only doing that indirectly, but you're really just moving the bodies up and down, and the bodies cascade, and, you know, your touch on one of them goes to the other ones, and it makes that, you know, the quadratic curve, the loop that gives the ground really that organic feel. So again, we got to go over this first. It's kind of like the meal before the dessert. So we understand what's going on in like the original iPhone version. All we have is triangles. That's the one and only thing that something like OpenGL can do for us. But triangles is really all we need because, again, just like the snot, we take points along the body from the physics bodies. We just calculate a point, and it's basically a point in the center of the body and an offset point. And we get a shape of points. And then from there, we have to do triangulation again to make a shape that roughly exhibits the same characteristics of the smoother shape. It's not going to get perfect, but it's going to get us real close. And you do that using, there's lots of different triangulation algorithms. I don't want to get into it because it would take us a lot of time. It would give me a headache. It'd give you headaches. And really, it should be Max really talking about this part, but unfortunately, he's not with us today, but he knows a lot more about this than I do. And then from those, once we get those triangles, we can use the same technique we did last time to make that blurred gradient around the edge of the body to give us the succinct, nice, round shape. In C#, this is another instance of performance. In the C# version for your Windows phone, it's actually not done that top way because it's too slow. To cut it up into all those shapes, it takes too much time, even for a language like C#. So he had to implement a second algorithm, which is basically kind of a a cheat. It's not a true triangulation, but it cuts the body up into two halves. He makes a triangle fan from all the points, and then to get the gradient around it, he makes another triangle fan, or actually a triangle strip around the edges. So those two things combined will still give us that same shape and look exactly the same. I encourage you to download, if you have a Windows phone, to download the Windows 7 version, compare it to the iPhone version. It works really well, and it's faster. It gives us what we need in less time. So for us in HTML5, it really isn't much different than it was the snap, because using HTML5, we are awesome and can use the same technique. We don't worry about triangulation. We just take the points around the body and, again, draw quadratic curves between all those points. So probably should have left that demo open now that I think about it, but we're just going to go back in and take a look at this again from the ground perspective. So this diagram is slightly more confusing, but we'll get through it. So this, again, that cool shape you just saw is, again, this is it. Like, it's not some mythical beast that, you know, is magical and we can never understand it. All this is the yellow boxes are, again, are those separate bodies, physics bodies, that make up the ground shape. And then the points you see, the purple and blue points, are the control points that we, again, make those quadratic curves move through to give us that final smooth shape. The purple points are the actual anchor points of a quadratic curve, and they're roughly in the center of the body with a slight offset to the top. And then the blue points are the control points. Basically, a control point for a quadratic curve is what gives the curve its shape. If I move the point higher, the curve moves with it. That's how a quadratic curve works in mathematics. So that's basically how that one works. Again, once you break it down and you in HTML5, if you don't have to worry about all the triangulation of a native language, it's a lot simpler. So that's another reason why working in something like HTML5 is a good way to get cool stuff, cool apps off the ground in less time. And some cases, you know, you don't need to understand as much if you were to do the same thing in like XNA or for the iPad. So the other part of the ground that we haven't really talked about yet is the gradient shading on the ground shape. If you've played the game or saw in the video, there's a gradient that is supposed to represent like a light source. It really gives the ground an organic, natural feel. If this was just flat black, it really wouldn't be that interesting. I mean, you know, you could move it, but artistically speaking, that shading gives it a lot of depth. And that's really, for a visual game like Contra-Jure, is really important to give it that depth and that feeling. So you can kind of see on the outer right-hand side the gradient on the shape. And to get that, again, remember, we have nothing but triangles, really. We could use something like a shader, but for iPhone, they don't have shaders at this point in time in the standard. So what we have to do is get the light angle from the game, which is just, it's not nothing fancy, it's just literally a value saying, hey, the light's in the upper right-hand corner. And then from that, we can take that point and then dynamically draw the shading in the same way we did with the snot. It's just a repetition of the principles we already knew. We've learned from past things. So we get a nice gradient that makes it look organic. And then on top of that, again, to get the smooth shape, we anti-alias the border with the same triangle technique. And that's what gives us the great feel of the game. So next step, of course, is how did we replicate this in HTML5? Succinctly to put it, we failed. I mean, there's no other way to really go around it. it's one of these things where while HTML5 is really cool, and I definitely suggest using it, it cannot replicate 100% of what you can do with a native application, with these, at least with these lower level graphics libraries. They've got a lot of lower level stuff that, while you saw, like, you know, working with just splitting up a shape into triangles is really, really not fun, really confusing, and performantly hard, it gives us more control over what we can do. And in the end, we can't do it in HTML5, at least not performantly. I mean, we could split up the border into triangles and apply linear gradients to each triangle, but, I mean, that's going to be slow. Even in today's hardware-accelerated browsers, you're probably not going to be able to get performance when you're moving the ground, or at least playable performance. So we kind of had to punt on it. We needed something that would give us a gradient without the performance cost. So a colleague of mine at our company came up with a method to shade the ground. And you can kind of see it in the diagram on the right. The biggest thing, or the best way we can save performance, is by recycling. I mean, use what you already have does not entail nearly the performance cost in browser as making something new. So we already have, if you remember by that code, kind of this, basically this not code is basically the same thing as this was. We already define a path in the HTML5 canvas by those quadratic curves. We draw that, we fill it to get the shape. But we, after we're done with that, we still have that path. So what if we take that path and increasingly stroke the path again? Stroking in HTML5 is, instead of filling, it just draws the outline of the shape, if you've never used it before. So if we just make that line thicker and fill it with an increasingly light border, we basically get a gradient. Not the same type of gradient, and not as you would using a normal HTML5 gradient or another gradient library, and not the same, doesn't have the same control, but we do get a gradient that will kind of give our shape a soft edge, which is really what we want. And again, just as a graphics reference, you can see here, this is what we came up with. It's not the same thing, and we make no bones about it being the same thing as, like, on the iPhone or the Windows phone. But you can see, instead of a black shape, we do get a gradient that progressively gets lighter to almost a white, and gives it, like, a feel of not being flat, of having character, of having substance. And that was the end goal, really. And we did successfully accomplish that. So again, while we couldn't replicate the same thing, we could make something that that will give us what we need without too much, I guess, prior knowledge, just reusing what we already have. So despite the optimizations we've done in the previous section, we still have more to do. And I wanted to bring this up because now that we've gone over the graphics, we can really see what we have to do here. Because in the end, over 30% of our time is still spent drawing images, drawing the ground. And in some cases, it's more than that. So you could potentially, I know in earlier builds, we had, 50% of the time of the game is not doing math, not figuring out the state of the world, not calculating touches, simply drawing everything to the screen. And that's really bad for perf. You really want to try and get that down as much as possible. But the question is really how? Like, you're just drawing stuff. Like, how do you make it so that it draws faster? We can't just rewrite HTML5 canvas, although, wouldn't that be fun? But we can't really just do that. We can't override it. So we have to figure out other ways. So really, the best way to do it is to not draw it. If you think about it, what's the cheapest way to draw an image? It's to not draw it. Even though that seems like, well, really, how can we do that? How can we successfully do that and keep the game's feel going? So what we have to do is, if you look at the game, you play the game, you notice there's a lot of background stuff going on. There's a lot of besides, you know, Petite and the Snot, which are all like front and center stuff that you use, there's like background particles, and there's like those big background guy eye guys and other elements, other particle elements, you know, just all these things that aren't, they aren't front and center, they're secondary. So if we could magically cut down on drawing them, that would be great for Perf and wouldn't affect the main components of the game. It wouldn't affect, you know, Petite rolling around and stuff like that, because you don't really primarily interact with that. You interact with other things. So what we did is we went with a multi-canvas rendering approach, which is really cool because it's really simple for you to do in HTML5. Because you can declare in your document as many canvas DOM elements as you want. It's not some super complicated process like it might be in, you know, a native language where you'd have to like do all these off-screen render contacts and like switch canvases and do all these things to get to kind of do this approach. It's simple. So what we do is, you can see on the diagram on the right, we split our game into multiple canvas instances, and we draw things in a speed of their layer, basically. The front canvas, which has the main things like Snots, Petite, any other, let's see, I'm trying to think of any other main interactions, cannons, all these things that you as a user interact with, they are drawn in a front canvas, and they are drawn at 60 frames a second. They are drawn as fast as we possibly can, because we need it to stay crisp. If you use your interaction like this, it needs to be as fast as possible so the users are happy. They don't notice anything, that we're doing anything different. So the secondary canvas, the back, kind of more of the background canvases, doesn't have to be drawn every frame. They can be, you know, it can be delayed. So maybe we aren't drawing it at 60 frames a second. Maybe we're drawing it at 20 or 30 because we don't necessarily need it to be that fast. But we make sure to update these elements every frame so that when we do draw, the elements stay in sync. They don't, you know, if something happened in the physics interaction, we don't want to miss that or something. So, but again, since a lot of the work is done at the drawing, not drawing them is the most important thing. So you might be thinking I'm crazy and like asking, like, really, how is this, does this really have an effect? So let's take a look, I guess. So let's go back to our canvas demo. If you remember, this is us drawing, telling the browser to draw 5,000 images every, 60 times a second. So what if we do something else? Since IE is still doing pretty good on this, what if we try and stress it out more? Oop, that's 1,000. That's not more. All right, 10,000. That's what I'm looking for. So now we're telling, okay, let's double this. And now IE is unfortunately struggling because we're trying to do 10,000 images. So we went from, you know, getting 50-ish frames per second to only, you know, 18, you know, less than 20, an unacceptable way to do this. So really, what happens now if we do this technique? So what this program does under the hood is, basically, I can specify multiple canvases, and each canvas I specify behind this basically implements that multiple rendering technique, where if the second canvas behind it will skip every other frame and just draw it, basically draw it half the time. The canvas behind that will draw it, you know, every third time, and so on and so forth as I render all these canvases. So what if I just do two? So here you can see we went from about 20 to about 30. So that's about a third increase in our FPS number at the bottom of the screen right here. And it looks a little different because I'm scaling up the image just a little bit so you can kind of see which layer is which, because I know it's a little confusing. But so we're getting a lot better performance. And really, you don't notice it that much because the elements behind on the second canvas are the only ones that are being rendered. Rendered slowly, it doesn't have that much of an effect. You can't visually see a difference because we are rendering faster than we were before. So it kind of evens out. And if I do, you know, three canvases, we're getting even more FPS. Now, this is one of those pick your poison things where you can, I could do this as many times as I want, but eventually it's going to get to the point where we start seeing really that we're not rendering every time once you get to, you know, rendering even less. So it's a pick your poison thing. It's a great technique. I encourage using it, but only use it for elements that don't matter as much and use it sparsely. But you can see here, we're getting almost what we got for rendering 5,000 particles, you know, at a time. We're almost getting to that performance level. So that's, like I said, it's a really good technique. So one last thing before I leave you, and so I can stop bothering you, because I know you guys all hate me by now. One last thing. The ground, remember that. It's huge. It's massive. It's made up of hundreds of different physics bodies at one time. And each of these bodies is part, or each of these bodies draws a quadratic curve through that. So think about that. We could be having ground objects that comprise of over 100 quadratic curves for just one. And on one level, we can have multiple levels or multiple of these elements on a screen. So that's bad. I mean, it's extremely expensive. We really need to stop this somehow. So, but at the same time, the ground is something that a user interacts with. We really, you know, we don't want to have like a choppy interface where, you know, you're moving the ground, but you can see it's not quite catching up to your finger. That would be a bad user experience, and that's even worse. So but we need to like combine those two, these two ideas, because the ground is a special case. We have a lot of instances where the user does not manipulate the ground. The user only, you know, will be manipulating other things, and the ground will stay the same. So again, if we use that multiple canvas approach, we can put each ground object on its own separate canvas. And then all we do is we only redraw that object on that canvas when a user is manipulating it. So, and when they do manipulate, we draw it at the full 60 frames a second. We try and draw as fast as possible so we get a smooth experience. And when you do that, you get, you know, a huge savings, because you're not drawing it when you're not doing literally anything when you're not manipulating it. So let me repeat that, because that's important. The most expensive object to render in our game costs us nothing, absolutely zero, to render when we're not touching it. So you can have as many as you want, and as long as you aren't manipulating it, you drew it once, and it's going to sit there in its own canvas and not do anything until you redraw it again. So it's, you know, so it's a ton of performance savings for an extremely expensive object. So that's another technique you can use. If you have something that only changes via user interaction or something, implement something like this, because it'll save you a lot of performance. So again, summary, please, please, please take into consideration your performance cost of the techniques we're using when you make HTML5 JavaScript apps, if they're going to be expensive, because you'll be surprised how little things that you do will add up to making your app either crisp and clean and 60 frames per second, wonderful magic, or, you know, a nightmare to play and basically unplayable game. You know, with touch, make sure you plan ahead and, you know, try and use some of the techniques I talked about when integrating touch, because it's a little tricky, but this way gives you a canvas that will let you manipulate your touch, you know, whether or not you scale your canvas and whether or not your fingers go, you know, maybe your finger might go outside the canvas browser and you don't want to lose interaction, or maybe your finger will go over another button DOM element and you don't want to lose interaction or anything like that. This technique will save you all that heartache. The last thing, graphics. I know we went over a lot of complicated things that you probably weren't expecting to go over, especially in maybe the UX section. So all I can say is at the end, if you forget everything else, you know, you blot my name from the history books, whatever else you're talking about, remember one thing. Please, when you're designing HTML5 apps, think about using the HTML5 canvas, because there are so many cool things you can do with it that you would not be able to do with just DOM elements. You can, even if it's not the main thing, maybe it's just an off-screen thing that shows, maybe you write your stock ticker in the canvas and make it do other complex things, like have particle systems and be all sorts of fancy, you know, lines fading in and out. Please think about using the canvas, because there are a ton of things you can do with it, and you can do them performantly in a way that has not yet been done in, you know, in HTML5 history. This is a whole new breed of web applications, a whole new breed of a next generation of web applications that can be built on things like IE10, browsers specifically made to handle this kind of stuff. So just keep those things in mind. Thank you for listening to my babble. You know, please don't beat me up on the way out. And besides that, that's all I got. So at this point, if anyone has any questions, I'm free to answer them. And I'll take that as a no. So thank you guys for listening to me.